Now, what happens in dreams, I call, or what we find in dreams, I use this expression, and I'll be using it more in the course of the semester. I don't know if it's the best expression, but I use the expression elemental symbols. And by that I mean trying to get some kind of technical term to speak about symbols that are not consciously created by a deliberate act of intention. I don't mean to say that all symbols that are consciously created by a deliberate intention are inauthentic symbols. By no means do I mean that. But I would say, for instance, the symbols that you find in the poetry of T.S. Eliot, extremely finely honed symbols that are a product of a very disciplined imagination. They're authentic. They are not, they say exactly what he wants to say. But they didn't emerge in dreams. They emerged in conscious, intentional performance of the poetic act. That's another kind of relationship between consciousness and the unconscious that is operative there. But he's definitely consciously and deliberately honing the symbols that he will use. For elemental, I'm using the expression elemental to get at these emerge without that conscious deliberate refinement. That's about what conscious deliberate refinement that is given, for instance, in the poetic act. It is a refinement. An authentic refinement. All great poetry is, but it is a refinement. It's not just releasing everything that is available, but it's shaping contours of what that is deliberately. Those of you who are artists would be able to say if that's also the case with other forms of art, but I suspect that it is a refinement. Work that needs to go into the creation of art. Now, what I'm trying to get at with elemental is not these are more authentic or anything like that, no. It's simply that they emerge without any shaping on the part of the intention of the subject. They are spontaneous expressions of the complexes of psychic energy. Spontaneous expressions. My point, and this is where I think find the whole structure of consciousness that I've been presenting to you, I really find it helpful. Where Lana is so helpful in just coming to terms with the whole science of depth psychology. These symbols, if they are taken up into the creative realm, intelligently, rationally, and responsibly, will provide me with some, at least, some of the images that I need for an authentic constitution of myself and of the world. I need at least some of the images that I need to authentically constitute myself as a human subject and to make my contribution to the making of the human world. Now, that last part there, the contribution to the making of the human world, is important, and that's where we get into 3A, the existential historical setting of the dream. The dream reflects directly a dialectic within the subject. What it manifests directly is a dialectic within the subject. What is a dialectic? A dialectic is a process that
that is rooted in two sources. That are opposites. And as the process goes forward, both of the sources can change. Whenever we're talking about a dialectical process, we're talking about a process that has two sources, and those two sources are opposites, and they get changed in the course of their mutual interaction. The two sources in this case, the dialectic within the subject, are consciousness and the unconscious. Those are the two sources. The process is the ongoing development of a person's life. So, the dream then, to spell out what I said about the dialectic within the subject, the dream is directly saying something about the development of my life. It's a process. And that development of my life has these two sources of, you know, where it goes. Where my life goes. The conscious, my consciousness, the decisions and so on that I make, and the unconscious. Those are opposites. Jung's whole point about the compensatory nature of the unconscious. They're opposites, and they get changed in the process of mutually coming into contact with each other. Consciousness is changed when it sets up an interchange with the unconscious. It gets relativized by being compensated for by the unconscious. The unconscious is also changed by the influence of consciousness taking it seriously. It gets changed. So the dream directly manifests the dialectic within the subject. But that dialectic within the subject takes place in the context of history. And so that dialectic is within the broader dialectic of history. And so, the complexes of my psyche, see, I didn't set them. Many of them were set for me by history. If you're born into a family that is somehow the victim of structural injustice, that historical reality, whose roots go back centuries, comes to some kind of a focus in the emotional complexes that are set for you from infancy onwards. Your emotional complexes are set for you by a whole dialectic. I'm just reading right now some of Max Horkheimer, one of the founders of the Frankfurt School of Social Research. And he's excellent on this sort of discussion, of how in modern times we thought with the Enlightenment that we had gotten beyond subservience to authority in history. You know, the Enlightenment really threw out the authority of tradition, the authority of religious leaders, the authority of monarchs, the authority sort of vested by natural right in, you know, kings and that sort of thing. All of that went. And the people of the Enlightenment developed what Horkheimer says correctly, the illusion that they were now free of authority and free to constitute themselves simply on the basis of their own understanding of the world. But Horkheimer says, by the time we get down to the 20th century, it's very clear that we may have thrown out all the authorities, but we don't have freedom, the freedom of the Enlightenment ambition, because of the economic determinations of our lives. And even the successful entrepreneur is really heavily influenced in the direction that his life takes by the economic necessities that influence him. And the people who have to work for the economic entrepreneur are even more at the victimization. And so we've got to move beyond what the Enlightenment did in order to emancipate the human person, to construct a social world on the basis of intelligence, rationality, responsibility, and love. All right, this is the kind of thing I'm talking about, historical influences on psyche. I think until depth psychology comes into full possession of the relationship between what it has discovered and the historical process, it is going to lead to narcissism, as it has done in so many instances up to this point. It's going to just be fostering what Christopher Lash calls the culture of narcissism, a book that was quite popular a couple of years ago, and which is a fairly good description. I don't think it gets into the basics. Description of a lot of what's going on in North American culture today. Until depth psychology can place its own insights into the context and is set by these historical, economic, social, political realities, it will not be freeing people for world historical responsibility, but will be focusing the attention of the person always just simply on oneself. A lot of the schools of depth psychology, round and round and round we go on the endless treadmill of self-analysis, because there is not the clear understanding of what makes for human flourishing. One of the things that makes for human flourishing is that I can make a responsible contribution to the emancipation of humanity from the bondage of what keeps it oppressed. Until psychology could place itself within that overall ideological, neutral context, it's going to foster a narcissistic attitude of the me generation. And the dreams can have very significant disclosures to give, not just about the dialectic that's going on with me, but also about the historical situation. This is what I want to get at, the existential historical setting. For instance, put it quite clearly, in the case of the kinds of insights that we find in Freud. The dream says, as Freud realized, and certainly all of the others would agree, the dream says an awful lot about where I have stood in my own family and how I have negotiated father complexes and mother complexes and so on and so forth. Okay. Now, that is not simply saying something about the dialectic within myself, the dialectic of consciousness and the unconscious within myself. It is saying that. It's also saying something about the family in contemporary society. It's also saying something about how the family functions in contemporary society. And so the dream can be a source of socio-historical criticism, not just a key to my understanding of myself. And I think until we move it to that point, until psychology moves itself to that point, it is taking the danger, the running danger of fostering narcissistic orientation on the part of the individual. You know what narcissism is, the fascination with self, so that you can't get beyond self and ultimately drown in the fascination with yourself. Alright, so our feelings are historically and socially conditioned. So the point I'm trying to get at here is that the dream tells me not only about my own inner conflict and how they can be resolved or how they break down or whatever, but it does, if I've got the proper tools of analysis, it does say something about the socio-historical setting in which my conflicts arose.
another example, I've dealt with a number of religious over the last few years, and they have dreams which refer them back at times to very painful events in their own history and religious life. The dream is saying something quite directly about the dialectic going on within them and how those events, which they repressed from their consciousness, went down into the unconscious and occasionally distorted their conscious life. Okay? But the dream tells us about what in the world happened to religious life in the course of its departure from Christianity. It's saying an awful lot about the socio-historical setting, so that it can be used as a tool of socio-historical things. Not just something to free the individual, but to free religious life. Get it back into touch with what it's supposed to be all about. Alright. The varieties of dream symbolism, maybe we'll take our break right now. I'll wait just a couple more. Most of the dreams that we remember are symbolic. Not all dreams are symbolic. Or, let me put it this way. Not all dreams are symbolic. Some dreams are prophetic. And there is sufficient evidence, a lot of which I accept, to indicate that people do dream about events that will happen that either directly affect them or that don't directly affect them. One of the most dramatic instances of that I've read about, and because of my own trust in that reality, I would say that I don't see any reason not to accept the evidence of the report of this particular dream. The bishop of Grosswardine, Hungary, the Roman Catholic bishop, dreamt of, he had been at one time a teacher of Archduke Ferdinand of Austria. And this particular night in August of 1914, he dreamt of receiving a postcard from the Archduke. And the Archduke wrote on the postcard, "I informed you that at such and such an hour this afternoon, my wife and I will fall victim to an assassination." And he was awakened by a dream, and the picture on the postcard was one of the very vivid in his memory, and he immediately drew what he remembered from the picture. And at such and such an hour that afternoon, the Archduke fell victim to an assassination. These kinds of things do occasionally happen. The meaning of that dream is not at all symbolic. It's a direct reflection of something that is underfoot in history. Now, how you explain this, I don't know. An awful lot remains to be discovered with regard to our whole understanding of energy. But at any rate, there are such dreams. I'm quite content to say that. The evidence is sufficiently in that sometimes the dream is prophetic, or it may also be synchronistic. That is to say, it may be reflecting an event that's going on at the same time in the outer world. Those are rarer than prophetic. Some dreams as well, there are many dreams that we cannot remember. The
people who have done empirical studies of these tell us that we ordinarily will dream on an ordinary night about 7 times. Many of those are in the deepest sleep, and we go into deeper and, you know, lesser degrees of sleep. And I think it's Rollo May, following Binsbacher, refers to some of them as dreams of the night. And the dreams of the night, what he means by that, are the dreams that we have in our deepest sleep, which are reflective of physiological processes within the body. They have no more meaning than that. You had too much garlic for supper, and the dream is somehow reflecting the discomfort the body is experiencing. You probably will not remember such dreams. We generally don't, because they are dreams, you see, where the whole psyche is really caught up in the physiological process of sleeping. So the physiological processes within the body come to some kind of imaginal expression in those dreams of the night. But unless you are awakened right after the dream, the chances are that you will not remember it, nor is it particularly important to remember it in terms of the existential setting of your life, whether or not you have too much garlic for supper. It's not a particularly important question for the way in which you constitute yourself as subject. Yes.
Because, you know, have dreams where, say, you've got a kind of job on this end of the line, and you're working on a particular part, and you saw that part all day and all night, and you just slept about it. That's all you dreamt about, was that part. Is that the same type of physiological question?
It may or may not be. See, it could have an existential meaning of routine and boredom and that sort of thing. It could be pointing to an existential reality in your life, that your job is boring, you're bogged down. Or perhaps the part is being used to symbolize something either physical or psychic. You see, I'd have to know more about the dreamer, and so on, to be able to say. I would say that most of the dreams that we remember do not have a purely physiological meaning, unless the dream is indicating sickness on the part of the person. And sickness, of course, is not just physiological in its significance. It has an existential meaning. Sickness, body sickness. And there are some dreams that the malfunctioning of a part, for instance, might, particularly if it's repeated, could indicate a serious sickness in the body. Could mean that. Recent Jungian research has gone into cancer and dreams. There's an article, a recent edition of the journal Spring, which comes out of Zurich, about 2 years ago, I'd say 78 or 79. Spring, I think it's the lead article on cancer symbolism. Obviously there, it's a physiological meaning, but it has tremendous existential significance for the person. This is the thing of knowing what the setting is in the individual's own life. Extremely important to me. Yes.
Obviously, sleep isn't a very technical word, since there are all these levels, you know, which should probably be a continuum. Has anybody ever tried to figure out, you know, what that could be psychologically, or in the relative terms of conscious, unconscious, when a sensor is more in and more out?
That's a good question. I'm sure that it has been done, but I don't know of the research on it. That's an excellent thing. The reason I say that I suspect that it has been done is that there's a lot of research that's been done recently on the psychology of sleep. I just haven't been at all. I sleep too much.
Whether or not they can
I don't know, what I would be saying would be extremely tenuous. I think that different chemical substances will have different effects. Alcohol, I think, would tend to put the person into a deeper level of sleep, I would suspect. So that whatever dreaming might be going on would be physiological more until the person is coming out of it. Certain tranquilizer drugs may be the same way. Yeah. Certain drugs, of course, as I mentioned in the last class, activate the psyche, hyperactivate the psyche in waking life, and cough up more material than the brain is capable of bearing. This is explanatory of a lot of what has happened in terms of the tragedies with psychedelic drugs. That more imaginative material has been released than the psyche is capable of bearing, or than the person needs. You know, the dreaming process is a natural process that gives you what you need for the constitution of your life. But you can release more than what you need, and then the confusion of sets in, and the overbearing, overpowering nature can be more than the personal power. But I'd have to do a lot more explicit work on that before I can say much. Okay, so those would be ones that we're not going to be dealing that much with, prophetic, synchronistic, physiological dreams. It's important with regard to the prophetic thing. Jung said the only way you ever know whether a dream is prophetic or not is to see whether the event that it relates takes place in life. There's no other way of knowing that. You don't know. Until that point, you have to suspend judgment on it. It's just not clear. All right. With regard to dreams that are symbolic, as I said in the last class, I want to go into this in more detail. I'm not just repeating myself on this because I covered it so quickly in the last class. Jung distinguished two levels of symbolic dreams, personal and archetypal. Said that personal dreams come from the personal unconscious and archetypal dreams from the collective unconscious. Collective unconscious for him is a level of psychic representation that all human beings share in common. So there are, for instance, certain symbols, archetypal symbols, that have a cross-cultural, universally human meaning. Water can symbolize the unknown, the depths of the water, you know, deep ocean. Can symbolize the unknown, not just for people in one culture, but across cultures, people from many cultures can relate to the depths of the ocean as a symbol of the unknown, unexplored. Now, how that will be able to function once we have explored the depths of the ocean is another question. At this point, it's still a legitimate symbol for the depths of the unknown. Water can also mean purification, cleansing across cultures. Of course, obviously, you take that up into religious symbolism, using the water for baptism, for instance. But it's a kind of meaning, symbolic meaning, that you don't have to have a particular cultural background to be able to understand. It has a significance that can be understood across cultures.
Water as the unknown seems to permeate a lot of the Old Testament apocalyptic literature, well, even the New Testament as well, and paradoxically it's also involved with salvation.
In other words, you're trying to get at what I was saying last time about archetypal and God. Let me get to that, and I'll try to explain the relationship there. personal dream symbols, as I said in the last class, are they're taken directly from your own experience. And they pertain directly to the circumstances of your own life. I gave you the one very clear instance in the last class of the fellow who was being chased by the professor in the wheelchair. That's a simple one, but the personal unconscious can be a lot more complicated than that. We have a lot of dreams, and I would say most of our symbolic dreams, take us back